Welcome to Philosopher Rock, Episode 6, The Doors. In this episode, GK and Brian will discuss the band, The Doors, their history, their music, and the philosophy of vocalist Jim Morrison. Their discussion will venture into some minute details of this dark and brooding band, as well as discussing some more subjective issues surrounding drugs, drug taking, and their effects on the user. And they discuss the mystery surrounding the death of Jim Morrison, plus which band he was thought to have fronted after his death. For more episodes of Philosopher Rock, just go to www.likeflintradio.com. If you want to contact us, email us at philosopherrock@gmail.com. Now here is GK and Brian with their analysis of The Doors.
Welcome to episode 6 of Philosopher Rock, The Doors. We're going to be talking about the magnificent group, The Doors. Just a little bit of housekeeping. Our new home, where you're going to find all of our shows besides our YouTube channel, is now Like Flint Radio. That's www.likeflintradio.com. Just go there and on the homepage, you'll find a link there. It's the square button with our logo on it. Hit that and it'll take you all the shows that we have for Philosopher Rock. While you're there, you can visit the other shows that are housed there. Like Flint Radio is now like a spot for our three or four different shows that we do, and it's just going to be a spot for all of those things to go. So you'll find our home there. If you want to email us, you can email us at philosopherrock@gmail.com. philosopherrock@gmail.com. Now, if you are a fan of The Doors, if you're a Doors aficionado, I'm going to ask you, on behalf of my co-host Brian, to be somewhat forgiving, especially of me here, as there is so much about The Doors that we could talk about. We probably say this every show, right? But there's so much that we won't be able to get into. And, you know, I can see it now that some of you are going to be saying, oh, why didn't you mention that? Well, it would be just hours and hours and hours, and we just can't do that. So I'm hoping that we're going to hit enough interesting points to keep your interest, even those of you who are well into The Doors and know all about them. And we'll even offer a couple little tidbits that maybe some might be new to some of you. So another point too, also, while we are going to be talking mostly, well, we're going to be doing The Doors, as usual for our program, we're also going to be focusing on one member for the most part. And that will be the philosophy of one Jim Morrison. For reasons, that will become clear as we go on. You're going to find out. So, I am your host, GK. And as usual in this show, my co-host all the way from Sin City. Now, that's C-I-N-C-I-T-Y, not S-I-N City, right? All the way from Sin City, USA is Brian. Welcome, Brian. What's doing, mate?
G'day, Garth. How you doing, mate?
I'm doing good. How are you going? What's happening in your part of the world?
Oh, it's beautiful here today. Great weather. We finally came off about 10 degrees and about 50% of humidity. So feels like a little bit of fall in the air, which I guess we're almost at that point. So yeah, it's a beautiful day. Sun's shining, not too hot. I got up early. Not that I wanted to, but I got up extra early, just because of coming out of a bad nightmare. So, I was a little bit fresher this morning due to the fact that I had about 45 minutes before I got online to start talking. So, yeah, doing good. How about you?
Yep, not doing too bad myself. Had a few rough weeks, to be honest, a rough 4 or 5 weeks. And I've got a few rough patches ahead of me health-wise as well. But I'm happy to be doing this with you and looking forward to talking about this. Before Likewise. We do go on, I wonder if you wouldn't mind sharing with our listeners where you went for breakfast the other morning, because you went and had a meal that I've never heard of before. Now, I like to eat, me and my family eat a fair number of German style and German foods and German meals. And but there is a German meal that is unique to Cincinnati, and you had some and you sent me some photos and I was totally jealous. Tell us a bit about it.
So, well, we went out for breakfast. My mother-in-law is in town staying with us. And she, every time she's here, she has a certain, protocol of things that she has to have while she's in town. You know, it's always food related. So, somehow over the past 20 years, we tweaked her to the dish or, food that's called Geta, G-O-E-T-T-A, Geta. And, it's a popular thing here in Cincinnati, and I believe that it's made here. Quite a few of the bigger brands of Geta are made here. That's probably due largely in fact to the, largely in part to the fact that, there's a large German contingency that lives in Cincinnati. And, we have an area called Over the Rhine, which is, down in, the lower, down by the river to the lower area of Cincinnati, which was where the Germans had originally settled, and there was a huge pork manufacturing or processing industry that was in the early years of the founding of the city. So because Geta is made of pork primarily, that was one of the foods that was popular around here. So we actually have a Geta Fest every year. They may not be for with the COVID thing, but usually every year we have a Geta Fest where, I guess there's different styles and different flavors of Geta. I'm not really all that into it. Now, I like it. It tastes good. But I don't usually eat it because it has onion in it most of the time. And, I am violently averse to onion. And, although I have done a little bit better over the years because I realize I just can't get around it. People put it in everything. And if they know me, they put it in there on purpose just to make me angry because people like to try to sneak it into my food. But, so yeah, Geta is kind of like a sausage. It's kind of got a little bit of like it's not as firm as a sausage usually. And I think that's because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there's oats in it.
Yeah.
And, that makes it a little softer.
Steel cut.
But it is good. It is good. It tastes good. I guess that my mother-in-law, tends to like this particular restaurant here. Because we do a little bit of exploration of like the smaller places around here. And I don't know which brand this place uses, or maybe they make their own. But anyway, that's pretty much what Geta is. And she likes it from that particular restaurant. So we went there, and although I didn't have Geta, I had an enormous omelet stuffed with sausage and other goodies. So it was good. I would have been jealous if I had seen the picture of that I sent you too. I was happy that I was on the receiving end of the food.
well, we're definitely going to try that out sometime in the future. My wife and I are seeing if we can source the ingredients, because you need the steel cut oats, not the other type. And we've tracked them down. I think they're available here in town, so you need to start with them. But anyway, let's move on. Let's get to the Doors now. Let's do a bit of a brief history of the Doors. We like to kick off our show with just a brief history of whoever we're talking about. Like I say, aficionados, you'll know all this stuff, but I hope as we go along we might hit some things that you don't necessarily know or heard before. They were formed in Venice Beach in 1965. they honed their skills in Sunset Strip clubs, you know, the London Fog and the most famous of all, the Whiskey A Go-Go. They had a record deal earlier.
Elektra.
No, it was somebody else, and then that fell through and they ended up going with Elektra. I don't want to say who it was. Something tells me. Yeah, anyway, so they got a good record deal with Elektra. They produced 9 studio albums, 6 recorded while Jim Morrison was alive. Then they followed that up with another 2 after his death, and then one more with Jim Morrison on the album posthumously. Now, talking about individuals, Morrison is a very interesting individual, but this is an interesting band. So I had a look at all of the members. I wanted to talk about them all. We don't always do this either, but kicking off with Morrison, you know, it said that he had no musical background before coming into the Doors. So we do know that he was wrote poetry and he wrote songs. Actually, you know, he arrived at the band with a group of songs. Who know where they came from? How did he write them? He didn't have a musical background. How did that happen? I don't know. Who knows? But he arrived with a bunch of songs. Bit of a genius, really. IQ of about a 149. Heavily into his literary sort of works of those like Kerouac, Ginsberg, and Burroughs, a number of philosophers, including Nietzsche. And it was said that even during his Doors career, he was never without a book. Right. And these are all heavy duty philosophical and literary works that he carried around with him. He quoted his musical influences as the Kinks. Good man. There's a number of people we've already talked about. It's the Kinks. Very important to a lot of them. The Beach Boys and Elvis Presley. Something of interest here. His middle name is Douglas, after General Douglas MacArthur of World War II, War in the Pacific fame. And his father was the U.S. Navy Admiral George Morrison, who was commander of the U.S. warships which came under attack in the Gulf of Tonkin incident in August 1964, which ended up kicking off the Vietnam War in a big way. So that's interesting to know. Now, he was raised in a very conservative military family that moved around a fair bit, like many military families do. And it seems that he revolted against this conservative upbringing, okay? This is what it seems like. I'm going to give you a quote here. In his official Elektra biography, Morrison famously wrote, quote, "I am interested in anything about revolt, disorder, chaos, especially activity that seems to have no meaning. It seems to me to be the road toward freedom. External revolt is a way to bring about internal freedom," unquote. So I quoted that so you can see where he might be coming from with his philosophy, and we will be getting into that a little bit later on. And I'm sure that was no news to you, Brian, for what you're going to be talking about later on from that quote. But let's talk about the drummer, John Densmore. I think a great drummer from what I've seen and heard. You know, he's a jazz drummer. He played in the high school marching band. He, interestingly for me, I think, he studied anthropology at UCLA, but he dropped out 1 year before he finished his course. And I've done a couple of university degrees myself, and I remember being at university with people and encouraging others, and those encouraging me, you know, when you're coming to that last year, it's really hard to get through it. And so, you know, you just got to keep saying, look, it's only a few more months, or it's, you know, whatever, and you got to encourage people to go. So it's a shame to see that he didn't finish that course. He had been a band previously with the Doors guitarist Robbie Krieger, and he met the keyboard player Ray Manzarek at a Transcendental Meditation course in 1965. Among his influences, he cites the Beatles and Van Morrison. Now, I'm going to quote you, this is interesting, we're going to be quoting a fair book from this book. This book, I'm going to, if you're interested in the Doors, this would be a good book to get. The book is by Richard Weidman, and it's called The Doors, FAQ, F-A-Q, The Doors, FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the Kings of Acid Rock. So I want to give you a quote out of that book. This is interesting. As the jazz player in The Doors, Densmore kept perfect time for Jim. According to Doors manager Bill Siddons in Follow the Music, Densmore left the band several times over the years in response to Morrison's drunken antics on stage. In Light My Fire, Manzarek caused controversy by claiming that early on in the band's career, Morrison told Manzarek he wanted the band to get rid of Densmore and find a drummer because he couldn't stand him as a human being. Manzarek convinced Morrison to keep the drummer, and obviously they did. One of the other sort of unusual things about these guys, now I know they didn't have a really long career, but the four of them that recorded that first album are the four guys that finished, you know, when Morrison died. So I think that's interesting. A lot of bands, even in their first couple of albums, have a lot of personnel changes, but these guys didn't. So they stayed together, the four of them, you know, right through those, what is it, six studio albums. Anyway, let's talk about Robbie Krieger, the guitarist. He started playing guitar at 17. He started playing flamenco guitar. He studied psychology for a short period at UCLA. See, all these guys are pretty smart, all, you know, college guys. After seeing Chuck Berry play, he traded in his flamenco guitar for a Gibson SG, which you see him playing almost every film clip I've ever seen of him anyway. He's always playing that Gibson SG. He was the last member to join the Doors, and he lists as his influences Fats Domino, Elvis, and Van Morrison. So there's two of them who cite Elvis and Van Morrison. James Brown, and interestingly, the Platters. I find that interesting. He wrote a few of the Doors' biggest hits, including their first number one, Light My Fire, which was also the very first song he wrote. I mean, that's not a bad start, Brian. What do you reckon? That's a brilliant start to anyone's musical career.
Yeah.
It blows me away to think about that. And he also shared vocal duties on the Doors' last two albums with Ray Manzarek, obviously because of the death of Jim Morrison. Now, quoting from the Doors' FAQ book, quote, Krieger related some early advice his father had given him when he first joined the band. The first time my dad met Jim Morrison, he looked at me and Ray and John and said, boys, I think we better invest in a good criminal attorney. And we did, unquote. So that's pretty interesting. I like that.
Yeah.
Now to Ray Manzarek, the keyboard player. Had classical and blues background. He studied Bach, Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky at the Chicago Conservatory, and was also heavily influenced by blues artists like Muddy Waters, John Lee Hooker. Yeah, love John Lee Hooker. And jazz artists like Miles Davison. And incidentally, he had held a degree in economics and also majored in cinema photography at UCLA, where he met fellow student Jim Morrison, and in the summer of 65, with Morrison, formed the Doors. Now, we'll get this bit out of the way right now, Brian. As an old ex-bass player, I want to talk about the fact that they, when they played live, they didn't use a bass player.
Right.
So Ray Manzarek, he, for the most part, used a Fender Rhodes piano bass. So he played the bass lines with his left hand, and he would play, you know, the keyboard parts with his right hand on another set of keys, which is quite interesting. I love watching that. Those Fender Rhodes piano basses, I wouldn't mind getting one myself, especially, you know, the sparkly silvery one, and I think that's the one he uses. But, of course, in the studio recordings, you'll find that they use session bass players, and even at one time they used Elvis Presley's bass player, Jerry Scheff, on the L.A. Woman album.
If I might, add a little bit of local pride here. So one of the bass players that they used, especially notably on Roadhouse Blues, was Lonnie Mack, which he's a guitar player, and he's from probably about 10 minutes away from here.
Okay.
He pretty much is associated with Cincinnati because Cincinnati is the biggest town closest to his hometown. But yeah, so cool. One of our locals was one of the bass players, so just wanted to throw that in.
That's interesting. Yeah, well, I didn't have that. I got this. I got the Elvis Presley connection there because a couple of them, you know, really liked Elvis, and I think, don't quote me on this, but I think they may have even brought this guy in, this Jerry Scheff, in on the L.A. Woman album to keep Jim Morrison interested, because I think he was sort of losing interest in recording and that at this stage. But don't quote me, but that's what I think might have been going on. But so Ray Manzarek began using Rhodes instruments when the group formed in 65. Like I said, he played bass lines on a piano bass with his left hand. But he also played a full-size Rhodes in the studios, and it was a Mark I Stage 73 on Riders on the Storm. And according to him, he said, quote, if Mr. Rhodes hadn't created the keyboard bass, the Doors would never have existed. Hmm. Now, I think also at one other time he used a Vox Continental and a Gibson G101. And I'm quoting these because I really do love me some great keys and great organ sounds. And so for me, that's the highlight of a number of the Doors tunes. It's Manzarek's mm-hmm. keyboard playing, and I'm fascinated that they didn't play live with a they didn't use a bass player. So they would have done me out of a job anyway. now, Morrison suggested the band's name from the title of Aldous Huxley's work, The Doors of Perception, which in turn stemmed from William Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which is a series of texts written in imitation of biblical prophecy, by the way, but expressing Blake's own intensely personal, romantic, and revolutionary beliefs. Quote, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite, for man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern. So I'm giving you some quotes here so you can get an understanding of where Morrison's philosophy is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember I give you that quote about if Mr. Rhodes hadn't created the keyboard bass, the Doors would never existed. Here's another little quote from Ray Manzarek again. Now, how about this? Ray Manzarek has stated that if Jack Kerouac had never written On the Road, the Doors would never existed. How about that? So he's got a couple of points there where he said they wouldn't have existed. One was, you know, Mr. Rhodes, who, you know, created the Fender Rhodes organ, and then we've got Jack Kerouac's work On the Road. But he says that sense of freedom, spirituality, and intellectuality in On the Road, that's what I wanted in my work, unquote. Both Manzarek and Morrison devoured the works of the Beat Generation writers like Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and William S. Burroughs during the late 1950s. Manzarek later remarked, Jim and I originally conceived the band to be a merging of poetry and rock and roll, just as the Beats, a decade before us, married poetry and jazz. So you can see where they're coming from there. I should say unquote, but you can see where they're coming from there. Okay, so that's a very brief intro to the band. So, Brian, I want to hand it over to you and tell us what you can about the musical genre and or styles of this very dark and brooding band, The Doors.
Yeah, so it's a little difficult to pigeonhole The Doors. I mean, there are some certain things that we can say. So, for example, there were heavy elements of the blues, jazz, as you had mentioned. At times, you know, being a musician myself, and likewise, you are a musician as well, but I mean, we were able to sort of discern some of these genres, maybe, and put a name to them. This is where most listeners might not know what they're listening to, per se, as far as genre is concerned. But the reason I say that is just because some people might not understand why I'm, you know, pointing to these particular genres as being in the Doors music. But anyway, there's a slight swing going on in some of the songs. And that sort of falls under the broader heading of jazz, I guess. But there's a little bit of Baroque type music in there, which probably comes from Manzarek's classical training. At the time, there was like a small, in rock and roll anyway, there was a small handful of bands that were doing what they would consider was called Baroque and roll or Baroque and roll. bands like the Left Bank were kind of in that vein. Now, Left Bank was more heavily doing the Baroque type style, but there was a blend of, well, I guess ultimately all these, the combination of amalgamation of all these things turned it into psychedelic rock, but there was a little bit of what I would consider proto goth, like they were kind of like the godfathers of gothic rock. And you see that come through like in bands later on in the 80s when goth kind of found its like heyday in the 80s. There was a lot of harken back to the Doors. Even like in, you know, the way that they dressed, there was kind of the same kind of like bands like Echo and the Bunnymen kind of like had that the Doors kind of vibe. And, you know, they played in minor keys. They would mix in minor keys, I should say, because there's a lot of major key stuff going on there. But I think that kind of contrast between the minor keys and the major keys kind of gave it that sort of dissonance or whatever, that kind of an uneasy feeling or whatever, that makes for a good gothic or psychedelic kind of music. But I think, you know, largely a lot of it was, and then there was the beat, kind of the beat style that was going on in there, that had more to do with the lyrics and the poetry, but it's also the delivery. It comes out through the delivery. And a lot of what the Doors were doing, I think, was they were reaching back, I think, where some of the bands in the late '60s were mid to late '60s were heading toward a new frontier in music. I don't think anybody really knew what it was going to be at that time, but the Doors were kind of had like an old school feel to them with, like I said, at least as far as the lyrics and the delivery was like pointing back to the '20s or, thirties, forties, with just kind of, a repackaged version of, like the beat poetry kind of thing, jazz kind of thing that was going on. And, like you had mentioned, I think a lot of it has to do with their training. And so Manzarek who said that the book Doors wouldn't have existed if it wouldn't have been for, I think he's right. I mean, I think that their influence was all pulled from, those, people that he mentioned, and, you know, writers, especially the writers in the beat poetry and the, French existentialism kind of, lyrical content. So, well, one of the other things too that might be important to mention is that, because they were, because especially of Morrison's and, Manzarek's interest in cinema and really kind of like theater,
right,
there was sort of a theatrical, almost like a show tune kind of element going on there, because there was a lot of, for a band that really, I mean, of course, I've never seen them, but I mean, I've seen some footage, and I know, you know, basically what their stage performances were like, but I think that there was, for a couple of guys who only had, you know, not even a bass player on stage, but just a guitar, drums, kind of like a scant crew of guys, they had a sort of like theatrical thing going on, especially with Morrison, you know, and it's like, so there was like almost a theatrical show tune kind of like element going on there. Like it was a performance on more than just the musical level, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. All right. I want to mention their first album. Like, we can't do a review of everything they ever did, but we're going to talk about their first album, because then I want to break down a couple of the songs from that album. So what we're talking about here is the album called The Doors, the 1967 released album. You know, considered one of the greatest debut albums of all time. And from that, it reminds me of Boston's debut album, not in sound, not in style, but the fact that many bands have got to slog out a few discs before they hit the big one, right? But Boston's first album, just brilliant. Like, I think it's 16 million units. I think it was like at the time, until Michael Jackson came along, was like the biggest selling debut album of all time. Well, the Doors debut album is a piece of brilliance, to be honest, and it's just a massive work that's brilliant. And again, I'm saying amazing that, you know, this group of people come together and put this out. And I'm not saying it wasn't hard work, but you get other bands, they'll slog away and they'll have a number of albums, and it'll take them a while before they get the big one. Anyway, so this album was recorded in August 1966 at Sunset Sound Recording Studio, released in January 1967. It features a number of their most famous compositions, Light My Fire, Break On Through, The End. Now, shortly we're going to be discussing a couple of these in detail, so I won't go into too much detail here. Interestingly as well, and I mentioned this earlier, their big hit, Light My Fire, was composed by Krieger, and the album version was just over 7 minutes long. You know, a lot of their songs on their albums were really long, And it was apparently widely requested for radio play at the time. So a single version was edited down to under 3 minutes, with nearly all of the instrumental break removed for airplay on AM. A lot of bands had to go through that, you know, in those days, because the radio stations didn't want to play anything that was longer than 3 minutes. And so, you know, a lot of the better songs are 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 minutes long, Brian, as you know. Think of, you know, bands like Yes and others.
Jethro Tull, Butterfly.
Iron Butterfly.
Vanilla Fudge.
Yeah. A lot of the better songs aren't 3 minutes long, but for radio, AM radio back in the day, boys and girls, that's all they wanted. They wanted 3 minutes. But anyway, also, like a lot of bands, when they kick off, they'd had a couple of cover songs. So Alabama Song and Backdoor Man are actually covers, and there's nothing wrong with that. I am came from a covers band, and so there's nothing wrong playing covers. Interesting. These sort of little things interest me, and I hope they might interest some of our listeners. Or they might think, okay, that's getting a bit into the minutia. But the mono recording, right, the mono disc, it's got some unique mixes that sound different from the stereo version. And the mono LP was deleted not long after its original release, right, and was unavailable in 2010, and it was reissued. See, because some people, I'm not a big fan of mono, by the way. I'm a stereo kid. I love stereo and even a bit of quad. But it was reissued. And the 40th anniversary mix of the debut album presents a stereo version of Light My Fire. How about this? In speed corrected form for the first time. Previously, only the original 45 RPM single, Light My Fire and Break On Through, were produced at the correct speed. What do you think of that, Brian?
I'm trying to figure out exactly what they mean by that. I mean, I understand the concept of the speed, but so can you elaborate on that any? I mean,
no, I don't know any more than what I've just sort of shared it with you, because I haven't listened to this stuff on disc, you know. But it'll be out there.
I know that because they used tape in those days, so the tapes ran at a certain speed.
Yep.
And then if the tapes didn't play back at the same speed, there could be a difference, and maybe that's what they're talking about. Because I know Billy Joel had an issue with that on one of his albums too, that had to get completely trashed because some issues with the speed. But that's interesting.
Yeah, I just thought that was interesting, and like I said, I hope some of our listeners do as well. Anyway, I will leave it there on that, because I want to get into a couple of those songs in detail. So did you want to have a bit of a yarn about the Soft Parade? Is that where you'd like to go next, or where would you like to go?
Sure. So Soft Parade came out in 1969, and when it was released, it was under a lot of scrutiny. I mean, there was a wide variety of critical opinions on this. And so the reason that I have a particular, I guess, affinity for it, or that it's relatable to me, like, it's just the fact that this was the one album. So I don't know. I know I had listened to The Doors prior to being introduced to the Soft Parade, and all I knew was their hits, just the, you know, the normal radio songs. And then friends of mine, people that I was hanging out with at the time, so we were all playing in bands, and it was all heavy metal, and, you know, we knew who the Doors were, but it was kind of like, yeah, you know, oldies music or whatever. Even in the 80s, we were calling, you know, 60s music, late 60s music, oldies, which is weird because it was maybe at the best 15 years old, but it was our parents' music, you know. And then something, I guess it was when that the Doors movie came out, was a huge shift happened, and really kind of happened in the culture, looking back on it. But within the group of people that I was, musicians that I was hanging out with, we were playing thrash metal, like, you know, Slayer and Megadeth and stuff like that. All of a sudden, the guys that I was hanging out with, they got into, you know, as soon as the Doors movie came out, they got into the Doors big time. And then they got into like hippie jam music, and Primus fell in there somehow. I'm not sure how, I guess, 'cause they're just odd. But, so the guys that I was hanging out with, where we were used to listening to Slayer and stuff like that, all of a sudden these guys are listening to the Doors, and they all got involved in using psychedelic drugs. Now we, as you know, our typical go-to was usually alcohol or marijuana or whatever at the time. But the influence of that movie on the people that I was hanging out with was huge, because it moved them into the use of psychotropic drugs. And one of the albums, I don't know, they particularly were fond of the Soft Parade. So they would listen to it. Actually, we would all partake of whatever whatever illicit drugs that we were fond of at the time, and particularly LSD. But there would be, you know, nights where we would hang out, and all of our partying moved from this wild, loud, energetic partying when we were using alcohol and whatever else, into this totally like turn the lights off, put a laser show on the ceiling, and turn on the Soft Parade. And it was, I don't know how many hours I must have stared at the ceiling watching lasers go across the ceiling listening to the Soft Parade. But I really grew to enjoy that album. And I, even at the time when I was listening to it, I thought to myself, this is like seems like a departure for the Doors. And it's almost, you know, bands, if they have their full run, it seems like every band will have an album where it's kind of different, and some people hate it and other people love it. And it's more of like kind of like their, I almost consider it from my perspective, like their pinnacle, like their best stuff, when they were their most explorative. And where they're most, sometimes it usually centers around like, an album like Soft Parade, where the members don't agree on everything. And maybe that's because they've all brought their own spin to it, and kind of thrown with a lot of the same, you know, the term too many cooks in the kitchen, like everybody's throwing their songs in, and not everybody's going to agree, but they let it go. The album still comes out with a wide variety of styles rather than one person writing all the material. And that was the case with Soft Parade and the song. And according to the Doors FAQ, the song Tell All the People, apparently Morrison hated that song so much that he demanded that his individual writing credits were placed on the album for the first time. So you get a sense of the fact that not even everybody in the band was happy with the songs on the album, or at least the way that they were done. And the album itself, like I said, it had got a lot of acclaim, you know, from different people, as, you know, some of it was, people were saying it's great, the best thing they've ever done. Rolling Stone album guide called it the Doors' shakiest album, and cluttered with horns and strings. But I personally think that that's part of what I'm talking about. They got more exploratory, and they were willing to push the boundaries a little bit, going into the fact that they used horns and strings kind of gave the album a whole different feel. I even think on the song Soft Parade, there's a little bit of like disco going on there. And that was before disco even was even a term. So they wouldn't have called it disco, but the drum beat that's going on there, and kind of this like little funky thing that was going on. But so Soft Parade, to me personally, is a great album. I think it's probably their best, because there's so much going on in it. It seems like they, and I guess if their intent or Morrison's intent was that the album, or, you know, if critics wanted to hear the same old Doors that they had heard on the other albums, I could see why this one would throw them for a loop, because it's like completely different than what they were going for. And I guess some people would consider that cluttered, that it's got all these extra instruments in there, and it's not the stripped down rock that they were used to. But I think it shows a more introspective side, and I think it shows a more a broader talent that the band had, that they were able to do music that wasn't just one style. Kind of, you know, a band like AC/DC, you get, you know, AC/DC's been AC/DC for the past, you know, almost 50 years, you know. It's like and they, there's not much change going on in them. And that's good for some bands. And, you know, people tend to want, when they listen to AC/DC, they probably don't want to hear violins or horns, you know. You don't listen to AC/DC for that. But the Doors, I think it just goes to show that they probably, had Morrison survived or, you know, hadn't passed away, that we probably could have got a lot more out of them as far as exploration into music. And the ties that that album has for me to my past is with all the drug use. And it kind of, like when you listen to the lyrics on there, the way that it's presented, it was almost like the album was made for people who were using LSD. And there's been like people who said, you know, certain movies are that way. Like, you know, you turn on a certain movie and it, you know, if you're on LSD, you know, it makes the trip that much wilder. And it's almost like somebody wrote it for, or filmed this movie for people who were using LSD to kind of make the trip wilder and more sensational. But yeah, I mean, that album, there was something different going on there. And obviously everybody picked up on it, like not just the band picked up on something different going on there, because there was turmoil related to it as far as they were concerned. And the critics, you know, realized that there was something different going on there. And so, yeah, I basically just was bringing that up because I just wanted to spotlight an album of theirs that seems to stand out, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It was a little different from their normal.
I just want to move now to a specific song. I think I mentioned earlier, I wanted to do this from the Doors debut album, entitled The Doors. I wanted to talk about the song called The End. Now, this is an interesting song for a number of reasons, and I'm going to be offering some quotes from our book by the Doors FAQ in a second here, and I encourage you, if you're interested, get this book. Okay, it's Rick Weidman, The Doors FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the Kings of Acid Rock. I'll tell you when I'm going to quote from that in a second here. But anyway, so the Doors song The End, I think a lot of us have heard this one. Almost 12-minute version was recorded live in the studio. They did two takes, and I've read that it was either the second take that they used, right, that we hear on the record, or it was a mix of both takes, so I don't really know. Some people reckon that you can absolutely hear from a cymbal crash where it switches to the other take, but I'm not too sure, so I'm not going to go with either point of view. Apparently, the song originated concerning Morrison's breakup with a girlfriend, but over the course of time, it evolved into something more. Interestingly, it was the last song the original group performed at their last concert on December 12, 1970 in New Orleans. Shortly, and I'm going to put links to these things in the show notes. There are some online stuff and a link to the book that I'm quoting from. But shortly past the midpoint of the nearly 12-minute long album version, the song enters a spoken word section with the words, "The killer awoke before dawn. He put his boots on." Now, that section of the song reaches a dramatic climax with the lines, "Father, yes, son, I want to kill you. Mother, I want to," and with the next words on the album version, you know, they're screamed out unintelligibly. Now, we're going to talk about what he was getting at there in a minute, so just bear with me. But Morrison had worked on a student production of Oedipus Rex at Florida State University, and Manzarek goes on to explain that he was giving voice in a rock and roll setting to the Oedipus complex. At the time, a widely discussed tendency in Freudian psychology. He wasn't saying he wanted to do that to his own mom and dad. He was reenacting a bit of Greek drama. It was theatre, so that's what Manzarek had to say about it. In Densmore's autobiography, Riders on the Storm, he recalls when Morrison explained the meaning. "At one point, Jim said to me during the recording session, and he was tearful, and he shouted in the studio, 'Does anybody understand me?' And I said, 'Yes, I do.' And right then and there, we went into a long discussion, and Jim just kept saying over and over, 'Kill the father, F the mother.'" You know what I mean by F. I'm just not going to say it because I'll have to beep it out so many times. It's just going to be difficult in the edit. But "kill the father, F the mother." And essentially boils down to this: Kill all those things in yourself which are instilled in you and are not of yourself. They are alien concepts which are not yours. They must die. F the mother is very basic, and it means get back to essence. What is reality? What is? F the mother is very basically mother, mother birth, real. You can touch it. It's nature. It can't lie to you. So what Jim says at the end of Oedipus section, which is essentially the same thing that the classic says, kill the alien concepts, get back reality, the end of alien concepts, the beginning of personal concepts. Right now, we have to talk about these things, Brian, so you can get an idea of the philosophy of Morrison, right? He is reading all these philosophers, he's reading all of these literary works, and it's coming out in his music, okay? Now, for the most part, we would reel back in horror at this. Well, I know I do, okay? This idea of, you know, the Oedipal complex, okay? But to understand him, we have to talk about it. So let me read some more. Now, we will be going to Weidman's book here. Quote, unique among rock and roll songwriters, Jim Morrison composed lyrics that reference visions of the French symbolism of Arthur Rimbaud, the stream of consciousness methods of James Joyce, the spontaneous prose of the Beat Generation, and the theatre of cruelty techniques of Antoine Artaud. In fact, rock critics often use such verbiage as Artaud rock and Joycean pop when reviewing The Doors. Morrison was fortunate to discover literature before he became interested in music and carried an old box of books wherever he went, full of such titles as On the Road, A Season in Hell, Ulysses, Journey to the End of the Night, and The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music. Now, that's Nietzsche, isn't it, I think? Anyway, all of these early influences would make their way into his lyrics and poetry in one form or another over the brief history of The Doors. So no surprises there where he gets his philosophy from. I just thought it might be interesting to explain a little bit about Joyce, James Joyce. I thought we might talk about that a bit, just so people know what we're talking about. And I don't want to get too dry or too deep or turn you off, but this is called Philosopher Rock. So we're going to talk about philosophy. We're going to talk about rock, right? That's the name of the show. So again, from Weidman's book, James Joyce. So, you know, he's 18... he lived 1882 to 1941. Quote, one of the lines in James Joyce's masterpiece Ulysses reads, every life is many days, day after day. We walk through ourselves, meeting robbers, ghosts, giants, old men, young men, wives, widows, brothers in love, but always meeting ourselves. One of the most influential writers of the 20th century, Irish novelist and poet James Joyce, was born in Dublin in 1882. Morrison first encountered the writings of James Joyce while still in high school, reading Ulysses the summer before his senior year. A modern retelling of the Odyssey, Ulysses takes place during a single day, June 16, 1904. According to fellow classmates, Morrison's teacher believed he was the only student in the class who actually understood the novel. Morrison also read Joyce's highly unconventional and difficult last novel, Finnegan's Wake. Joyce's influence can be found in Morrison's stream of conscious lyrics. So take note of that. Stream of conscious lyrics, most notably in The End. So that's what we're talking about here, the song The End. In fact, influential rock critic Richard Goldstein echoed this relationship in his article, The Doors Open Wide, for New York Magazine. The End is 11 and a half minutes of solid song. Anyone who disputes the concept of rock literature had better listen long and hard to this song. This is Joycean pop with a stream of conscious lyric in which images are strung together by association. Okay, so Joycean meaning James Joyce, right? The End builds to realization of mood rather than a sequence of events. Now, I know that was a little bit long and a bit of a long quote, but I wanted to throw that in there so that you get an idea of what we're discussing here, how deeply influenced Morrison was by these philosophers that he read. And it 100% comes out in their lyrics. It comes out in their music, okay? So these aren't just things that are lines plucked from nowhere. And I know we're talking about, you know, his stream of consciousness, lyric writing and all of that. But within that comes, he's quoting directly from a number of these philosophers and literary, well-known literary figures from from that era that he was into. So I think that's why I had to share that with you, so you get the point of what we're getting at here. Okay, I want to get into one more song here. A brilliant song. I like this song. A lot of people love the song. Riders on the Storm, from the album L.A. Woman, 1971. Interesting again. Here's some, yeah, these little tidbits I like. It's the last song recorded by all four members of the Doors, and it was Morrison's last recorded song to be released in his lifetime. The single was released in June 71 and entered the Billboard Hot 100 the week ending July 3, 1971, and it was that was the same week that Jim Morrison died. It's partially inspired by spree killer Billy Cook, who in the early 50s murdered six people after they picked him up hitchhiking. You ever seen the movie The Hitcher from the mid-80s with Rutger Hauer?
I never have, no.
Great movie. Rutger Hauer, Dutch actor. Now, there's been a few movies about hitchhikers. You know, you pick up the hitchhiker and, you know, he ends up murdering everybody, okay? Well, a lot of those movies, a number of them are based on this guy called Billy Cook, who was a spree killer. Like, he killed a whole family, mate. They picked him up on the side of the road. They were very kind to him, and he murdered, you know, mum and dad and the children. It was just horrible. But anyway, so that's what this song is partially based on. But again, here we go into philosophy. It's also influenced by the German philosopher Heidegger. And the concept of thrownness, right? Now, I can't go into this too much, but I'll try and do my best for you. Thrownness comes from, because he's a German philosopher, so it comes from the German term geworfen, which means to being thrown, right? And it describes humans' individual existences, right, and being thrown into the world. And hence the line from the song, "Into this world we're thrown." Geworfen, so thrownness, geworfen. Thrownness denotes the arbitrary or inscrutable nature of Dasein. Now, Dasein is a German word that means being there or presence. And it's from the German da, which is there, and sein, which is to be. And it's often translated into English with the word existence. Now, this Dasein, and so geworfen, Dasein, it connects the past with the present. The past, through being toward death, becomes a part of Dasein. Awareness and acknowledgement of the arbitrariness of Dasein is characterized as a state of thrownness, in the present with all its attendant frustrations, sufferings, and demands that one does not choose, such as social conventions or ties of kinship and duty. The very fact of one's own existence is a manifestation of thrownness. But you can see where this is coming from in his outlook on life, his philosophy, okay? He's obviously being heavily influenced by these philosophers, and it's coming out in the music, it's coming out in the lyrics, but I would argue it's always also coming out in his lifestyle choices, can we put it that way, and his behavior. What do you think? What do you think? I'll leave that there. There's so much more we could do, and if you're an aficionado, you're going to say, why didn't you talk about this? Well, we just can't do everything, so please understand. But anyway, if you've got any further thoughts or suggestions, want to make comment on anything, go to our YouTube channel and make your comments there. But we'd love to see what you've got to say about this. But moving on, Brian, what do you think? Can you go into a bit more on the philosophy aspects of Morrison?
Sure, yeah. So I think what you said was very helpful and insightful. I'm glad that we're doing this the way we are, because you're covering some ground that I didn't come across. So that's great. But yeah, so I mean, a lot of what Morrison was into and reading or whatever, like you said, you mentioned some of the writers he was into, but there's, I just kind of categorized it under a couple of headings. Like, so he had a very libertine sort of view of life. There was a vagabond element, kind of like nomadic, coupled with hedonism. I think that a lot of the way he lived his life and the way he saw things was kind of like, if it feels good, do it kind of attitude. I mean, maybe not, he didn't expressly say that. Now I listened to quite a few interviews with him in preparation for this podcast, this episode. And first of all, I can tell that he's intelligent. and this is probably going to come up anytime we cover in every episode when we talk about like a specific figure in a band, but you can tell he's intelligent, and I can tell he's intelligent because he was almost painfully would sit and think about what he was going to say before he said it. Now, you know, we've seen that, like our last episode, we were talking about the guy from Ghost, how people ask him questions. Dio was the same way, Ronnie James Dio. Like when you see them in an interview situation, somebody asks them a question, they pause, they think about what they're going to say. And I think it's because they are considering what they're going to say, and they have to make it try to, well, maybe different. They may be coming at it from different angles, or somebody, they might think like, okay, I want to be consistent here, so I'm gonna make sure that what I'm going to say lines up with everything else that I've already said. Morrison, sometimes I think, actually would try to throw the interviewer for a loop. He seemed like he wanted to try to push the boundaries. And I would like to think that he was trying to get the interviewer and the, you know, final reader of the interview to think, you know, a little bit more outside the box. But there's a little bit of, there's enough arrogance in the mix with Morrison that I think he probably was thinking to himself, I'm smarter than these people. And he may have been. And so there was a little bit of, him trying to make it sound confusing. Cause I think a lot of times what happens is people, if they can say something that other people don't understand, that's a way of elevating themselves. I mean, honestly, if I'm being honest and I'm trying to be, there's been times, you know, when I've had information, or I thought I had information that somebody else didn't have. And in order to prop myself up, I would say it in a way that sounds like, you know, heady, you know, something, you know, real highfalutin sounding, you know, terminologies that that some people might not get, and where they have to ask, well, what's that mean? Well, it raises, it elevates us. It's sort of an ego trip. And I think that Morrison for sure was on, you know, at least at certain times he was on an ego trip. And then I don't mean to say that to be disparaging, but I mean, we're just going to find that we're all that way, honestly, if we're being honest. So, he had this hedonistic outlook on life. You had mentioned the Oedipus complex, which I thought was in the sort of the breaking down of how that plays out. And I thought that was interesting because of some of the interviews that I had listened to with him. He had talked about how he thought that the role of the female in the future. Now, keep in mind, these interviews were late '60s, early '70s. His take on, society was that the role of the female was going to become more dominant in society in the future. And we have actually seen that for sure. You know, right now, I mean, it's kind of like feminism is at an all-time high, and the male in society right now is kind of being looked at as, you know, unworthy, or what's the word? Villainized, I guess it would be a right word. And, so really, you know, it kind of just masculinity in general. And I think that because he was so deep into these philosophies, like nihilism, and escapism, because he was so deep into these philosophies, I think he had the insight to see the proper outworkings of these if they come to their fruition, where some people probably might subscribe to things and they don't really, and this is definitely true, people adhere to a particular philosophy, but they don't see it all the way through. They don't have the vision, they don't have the intelligence, or maybe they just don't have the wherewithal. They're just too lazy. So they don't see the, you know, the final outworkings of their philosophies. Now, Morrison, I think he saw what was going to, if this philosophy played out, in society, which it did, because that was a turning point. The late '60s was one of the turning points. And I like to use the analogy from Seinfeld that Jerry Seinfeld uses for, you know, relationship breakups. He says, you know, sometimes you can't really just, you can't just break up with somebody. You have to, it's like a knocking over a soda, like a a vending machine, like soda vending machine. He's like, you got to rock it back and forth a few times for it to go all the way over. His meaning was that you have to, you're kind of, you break up, you get back together, you break up, get back together. And I think that's kind of the way it's been for society, especially in the West, at least anyway. I know that a lot of what we're saying is probably going to be centric to the Western world. So the idea that, you know, in the late 60s, there was this hump that they were getting over, this change that was happening, but it didn't fully take. It didn't kind of like get its legs, so to speak, you know, full force. But it was like a first push of rocking the machine to get it to fall over. But I think that Morrison probably saw that society was headed that way. I think he pretty much said as much in a couple of the interviews, and that if it continued, that would be the outworking of it, would be the sort of masculinity going by the wayside and the female taking a more dominant role. So we see that. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about nihilism proper, because there's different ways to cash that worldview out, just like there are with any worldview. People take different little flavors of it and kind of mix and match, or they, you know, you get enough people, you're going to have that many opinions. You got 10 people, you got 10 different opinions. And that's kind of the way it is with nihilism, like any other worldview. So nihilism basically is, in a nutshell, is the idea that there's no objective truth, there's no objective purpose. And so, you know, writers like Jean-Paul Sartre and Camus, these guys would have been people that, and the ones that you had already mentioned would have been people that authors that, that Morrison would have been into reading. And I guess what it ends up, you know, the people who read, the contemporaries of those writers were writers probably like Burroughs and things like that. These people are trying to find meaning, I guess. And what's happening is they're not finding it in a way that's satisfactory to them, I'm guessing. So what they're trying to do is look deeper, and they seem to find that there is no meaning, no objective purpose. Now, this is interesting, and I'm going to tie this back real quick to the Bible, because you and I as Christians, you know, we find our meaning in God's word, or we find a grounding in God's word. And the book of Ecclesiastes is all about this. It says, you know, that foolishness, it's life is meaningless and foolishness. Now, that's not the ending principle of the book. What he's getting at, what the writer Solomon is getting at with Ecclesiastes, is that without God, and he says as much, without God, life is meaningless. Now, when we look at the lives of these people, is God active in their lives? I would say not, in the sense that he is as one like who we are as a Christian, because they're finding exactly what the book of Ecclesiastes says, is that without God in your life, as your grounding, as your focus, that life will be meaningless. So one of the problems that I'm going to have with nihilism is the idea that it's self-refuting, in my opinion, to say that life has no purpose or life has no meaning or objective. And it's important to say objective, because subjective things, we can all just, that's like flavors of ice cream. It's found in the subject. You know, Garth likes Geta, and well, Garth hasn't had Geta, but when Garth eats Geta, he'll like Geta. Now, I don't like it because it has onions in it. So that's a subjective thing. But objective means that despite what we think, what Garth or Brian thinks, objective means that it's true regardless of if anybody believes it or not. And so nihilism, to say that, you know, there is no such thing as objective truth, well, it undercuts itself in the statement. I mean, how can that statement be true? So and then the idea of escapism. So these guys are looking for a way out because they can't find or ground objective meaning because they don't have God. So they're not able to ground that. So they go, well, you know, life must be meaningless. And so one of the reasons I think that Morrison was so into drugs and alcohol was a means of escape. And he was into trouble and drugs and things before he became famous. He had been arrested previously for public intoxication at like a college football game or something. So it wasn't like once he once he got into the limelight, that's what did it. Because, you know, a lot of times, you know, and it's true that sometimes when, you know, with fame comes, you know, drug abuse or abuse of things. And it's, you know, the abuse, first of all, comes from the idea that, so as human beings, we were created for a purpose. And that's what nihilism says is not true, but the Bible says we were created for a purpose, and the purpose that we were created for is to worship God. That's where we would find our ultimate satisfaction. So because, like any other thing that has purpose, we were created for that purpose, to worship God. If we're not finding that, if we're not engaged in that, then we're going to worship something else, because that's what we were created for, was to worship. So people create idols. This is where idolatry comes in. People set up idols, and they, because we as humans are created to worship something, we will worship something. And of course, God wants us to be rightly related. He wants us to worship Him, which is the highest, not something inferior, like something else that's created. Because if it's not God we're worshiping, then we're worshiping something that's created, and that's inferior. But what they do, what they want to use the drugs, which would, you know, could classify as an idol, it's an escape. So it's an escape from what they seem to find as, I mean, I could see that if you thought that life was meaningless, then the question really is, why not end your life? And honestly, when we're using drugs and alcohol, we're poisoning ourselves, but it's an escape. It's a way to try to give us some comfort. We talked about this a little bit in the ghost episode you did. We use drugs and alcohol to kind of soften the what we perceive as, you know, pointlessness in this world. But I think the escapism itself is a tacit acknowledgement that something's wrong. It's pointing to the fact that there is a way that things should be, and I'm not finding it. And, you know, one of the things that in the movie, at least Morrison, the Doors movie, he screams out, and I think this is because there's a live version of him saying this. Maybe you can let me know if it's true or not. But there was a live performance, and he screams, "You're all just a bunch of slaves," you know, and in one of his drunken rants on stage. And the funny thing is I think he's right, because if you worship the wrong thing, you become a slave to whatever that thing you worship is. And so drugs and alcohol will end up running your life. It will be the thing that you sacrifice all your other things for and to. And so we become slaves to sin. And that's what Christ came to set us free from, the slavery to sin, to be a slave to Him, which in reality is very, he says His yoke is easy. So, I mean, you think about it, getting drunk every day, it takes its toll. Being under the yoke of all these different sins, it takes its toll on us physically, mentally, and spiritually. And to be under the yoke of Christ, our proper orientation toward God, it's very freeing. And I think that with the psychedelic drugs that Morrison was using, I think he had some insight, because I do think it does open, or so quote unquote, cleanse those doors of perception. Now, is it giving us ultimate clarity? I don't think so, but it does strip some of the things away. And I did some studying on DMT and psychedelic drugs. So Morrison, having been, you know, involved with using, and maybe the rest of the members of the band, but using the psychedelic drugs, I think it could have possibly given him some clarity and cleanse those doors of perception, quote unquote, that you had alluded to earlier. And, you know, one of the active ingredients in some of the psychedelics is dimethyltryptamine. And there's been studies that have been done on the brain, and it shows that there are changes that happen, you know, now that we have the technology to look inside the skull and examine the brain. Now, I'm not talking about the mind. Let's keep in mind, no pun intended. Let's keep in mind that the brain is a device that the mind accesses for us to interact with reality, the reality of the physical world. So just making that distinction. But the DMT and the psychedelic drugs have an effect on the brain where what the scientists call ego disillusion. So due to like a reduced activity in certain areas of the brain, the areas of the brain that have to do with the ego. When that activity, a lot of people think that the activity speeds up brain activity because when you're, I can speak from experience, when you're on psychedelic drugs, it feels like things are going fast, like information overload sometimes. But what actually happens in the brain is that the area of the brain that's responsible for the self, the id, the ego, it begins to slow down. The activity begins to slow down. And so it's almost like the self is fading away. The ego is starting to disappear. And so you're starting to see reality in a sense, without the distinction between you and reality. You start to become one, so to speak. I think that because these drugs have been around for so long, I think this is kind of where the Eastern philosophies get some of their oneness, their monism and things like that. And we could talk about that. We've talked about it, touched on it in other episodes, and hopefully we'll get into even deeper in future episodes because there are bands that are more specific to that worldview. But the drug, when Morrison or whoever's using these drugs, it does strip away and kind of give you almost raw perception. Now, like I said, it's raw perception of the physical world, and that is not necessarily something that's happening, that we're getting into spiritual realms. But I personally believe that it is because of an experience that I had with what I consider to be a spiritual being who told me things, that I would have never thought of myself, gave me quote unquote insights. So the drug strips away some of the things that are built up that our mind produces, I think, in our day to day, physical, you know, interaction with reality. And so for Morrison to be able to kind of step outside himself on these drugs, I think that honestly, when he's able to get a clearer picture, I think people, when they're on this, they get a clearer picture of a certain aspect of our reality. And when they do that, they realize that something's wrong. They realize that, yeah, there's some kind of slavery happening here, that we're bound in a sense to something. Now, Morrison doesn't cash it out in the right way, I don't think, because I think what we're bound to, again, like I said, is sin. And, so he makes that realization. He understands that. He just doesn't have a way to ground it or to, explain it. And I tried to find everywhere I could to find something about him. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I just couldn't find it. Something about him talking about religion or God or Jesus, but I couldn't find anything because I would be really curious to know what his take on Christianity would be, or for that matter, even theism. But nihilism, you know, is a bankrupt, to me, is a bankrupt philosophy because it's self-refuting to start with. And, you know, of course, when we get to that point where we're disillusioned, like Morrison was, you know, our options, you know, are limited. I would say escapism, hedonism, you know, is kind of like, hey, you know, if life is meaningless, I might as well at least feel good while I'm here until I'm gone. And it's kind of funny because it's such a contrast, like a dichotomy that happens with, you know, you got somebody like Morrison who is trying to say, so I think it's interesting because there's a dichotomy going on with Morrison where he wants to consider himself maybe, or he wants to look at things and say that, you know, other people are slaves or whatever, how he's perceiving things. And that, you know, there's kind of like an underlying admission on his part, or an underlying, thought that I lost it when the dog barked. So I find it interesting that there's almost a dichotomy with Morrison as far as, well, we know now science shows us that the dissolution of the ego or ego death, on these psychedelic drugs. And then, his experience with those drugs probably showed him that and cleansed those quote unquote doors of perception. But then, you know, when he was in his lyrics and his projections to people, he came across as highly egotistical. I mean, you got the drug, which strips you of the ego, and then he comes across as kind of egotistical in a sense of, you know, not maybe not outright saying it, but kind of like, I'm going to teach these people something. I'm going to, you know, I have something to say, which is an odd thing for a person who believes that there's no purpose to life or point to life. Like, then why front a rock band and have a message? If there's, I mean, in order for there to be a message, there has to be some sort of teleology. And this is why I think all this building up to this point, I think is interesting as to why there was some mystery surrounding his death. And so for those who may not know, they finished recording the album, their last album with him, but, you know, not counting the posthumous, but, and he decided he was going to, you know, they said that the members of the band said that it was always the case that Morrison wanted to be there when the mixing was going on. And that makes sense because the guy seems like, you know, as artistic as he is, he would want to make sure that it was just right. And so the mixing wasn't completed for the album. And he thought, you know, he had said to the band members, hey, you know, sounds pretty good to me. I'm going to go ahead and take off. And, you know, they said, where are you going? He said, I'm going to go to Paris for a while. And they said, well, how long are you going to be gone? Well, I don't really know, you know, but, you know, just keep me up to date on how the progress is coming with the album. So you've got to keep in mind, there's a couple of different factors here that play into this, but not only, you know, what we've talked about so far, but Morrison was in trouble with the law because, he had exposed himself at a concert. And I think you get what I mean when I say exposed himself, but, at a concert in Florida. So he was facing he was going to have to have a trial because he was in trouble with the law. So they were probably going to bring him to Florida to try him for the public exposure case. So he was going to, you know, he told the band members he was going to go to Paris. He didn't really know for how long. He left without even hearing the final mix of the album. And, there were a couple of other like odd things that he said. I can't remember all of what it was now, but he ended up going to Paris and, they know that he had spent some time, you know, going around to different, bars and nightclubs and things like that while he was in Paris. They have a line on kind of some of the stuff, his activity over there. But then, there had actually been previous accounts where people were saying that he had already died. And, you know, so the band members, there was a couple of different times that happened. So the band members, you know, were thinking, oh, geez, here's another, you know, they got word that Morrison was dead again, you know, it's like, so they just kind of like wrote it off. And, then I think it was, Manzarek said that he got a phone call from the band's manager and said, you know, Morrison's dead. And he's like, yeah, whatever. He's died two or three times now. So let me know when you find out anything for real. So I guess the manager went to Paris. He got over there and then he called Manzarek and told him like, no, like he's dead. He's actually dead. I'm here. You know, the coffin's right here. And it was interesting. I think Manzarek then flew over there and he said, well, you know, did you look at the body? And he's like, no, the casket was already closed. The manager, he's like, you're the manager of the band. You know, you should have some of the most interest in finding out whether or not this guy's alive or not. But nobody actually saw the body. And I'm not sure if they've ever even finally said what the final reason for his death was, other than some sort of mixture of drugs, but heroin and maybe alcohol or something. But it was just interesting because, given what we know about Morrison, it wouldn't, and I think this is why so many people have, you know, there's like it's not a huge theory, but I mean, there is a theory that, you know, he faked his death and took the money and ran basically. And I could see that with Morrison. And I think most people who know anything about him could see that he'd do something like that too. It's not something that, you know, we've never heard of that happening and then people finding out later that the rock star, so to speak, was alive still somewhere hiding out. But you could see where Morrison was in his element in Paris, you know, a city that where a lot of the things that he espoused or things that he kind of believed in that kind of generated from that area. And then this is just an interesting aside that there was a band that came out, a band called Phantom, which is okay. You got the name Phantom, and they put out an album. I'm gonna have to find out what year. I think maybe it might have been 1973. But they had an album called Divine Comedy. And when you listen to this album, it sounds like The Doors and it sounds like Jim Morrison singing. So when the album came out, a lot of people were like, that's Jim Morrison. You know, he's not dead and he's doing this other band. And the photo on the album is reversed. It's got a negative image on the photo of the guy that's on the cover. So it's kind of hard to tell what the person looks like. And so I think, I mean, I don't know how popular it was because I wasn't alive in I was alive in 1973, but I was only 2 or 3 years old. So I don't know how much of a stir it caused, but the album came out and people said that this was Morrison, you know, alive doing albums under, you know, the band name Phantom, which is kind of funny, and then Divine Comedy. And it does really sound like him singing. Now, if that was all the information we knew about that, then we might be left scratching our heads. But it turns out that that band, Phantom, oh, and by the way, that they were credited on that album as the members didn't have names. They just had letters. I think it was like X, Y, and Z. And if that would have been all the information we had on this, maybe, you know, like I said, we may still be left scratching our heads wondering. But it turns out that they do know the members of that band, what their names are, because they had another album that they had recorded, which for whatever reason never got released. And the main guy who was the more quote unquote Morrison figure, the singer or whatever, he's actually, you know, documented and well known in the music scene in New York, I believe it is. So, you know, for a minute there, it seemed like the Morrison, you know, death, faking his death kind of thing might have had a little bit of something to it, but, you know, in hindsight, it doesn't. But now, I mean, as far as it's related to Phantom, now, whether he did or not, I don't know. The whole thing sounds a little bit weird that no one ever saw the body. I mean, I don't really know, you know, what international law is, especially in France. I don't know what their policies are on when people die. It just seems like some family member or even a friend, it might have been, you know, wanted to see the body. Why they had a closed casket, you know, was that Morrison's, desire, you know, that he wanted a closed casket. And there was an interview that I had listened to with him where, the interviewer had asked him, you know, you probably amassed a decent, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, you probably amassed a decent amount of money now, you know, and there were a couple of just weird little things that Morrison had said, you know, like, it wouldn't surprise me based on what he had said that if he had decided that he was going to take the money and run and just, you know, live somewhere, you know, in like a hermit somewhere, and just kind of like, you know, shrug off his identity. And, so yeah, I wanted to just throw that in as an aside, but I kind of went off for a long time here, maybe a little bit longer than I should have. And
Brian, wonderful way to finish the show. That was news to me. That was very interesting about that band Phantom. And as you were talking about them, I was thinking about the band Ghost and the Phantom, Hagstrom Phantom, and so Hagstrom Phantom guitars that they play. For more on that, go and listen to our episode number 5 on Ghost. Before we go, Brian, need to ask you.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. What's on your turntable this week?
I'll tell you what's on my turntable because it's been on my turntable for several weeks now. I came across an album. I already had maybe one or two albums by this band, Fandango. Joe Lynn Turner's band before he was in Rainbow.
Oh, yep, yep.
I picked up a pristine vinyl copy of the album Cadillac by Fandango, and it is just, if you like Rainbow, if you like Joe Lynn Turner, man, I'm telling you, this is a great album. It's punchy. It rocks hard. It's got everything that Joe Lynn Turner brings to a band. So I've been spinning that pretty heavy rotation lately. It's called Cadillac. That's the name of the album by Fandango. Now, that's not to be confused with the other Fandango. And I never was clear. I haven't done my homework enough to find out whether these bands are tangentially related or not. The two different Fandangos, but the one's got an ex member of Deep Purple in it. And the other one was an American band. So I'm guessing they're not related because Fandango with Joe Lynn Turner was American and the other Fandango was UK. But yeah, so that was like 1978, I believe, was the 77 or 78 was the Cadillac album from Fandango. And man, it's a rocker. If you like straight ahead rock, but I mean, that's what's been on my turntable. There's decent guitar solos now because remember, you know, like he went from that band to Rainbow with Ritchie Blackmore. So it's hard to compare. But I mean, for a band that didn't really get a whole lot of like attention in the USA, I think there's some good guitar solos. Yeah, I mean, it's no shredding or anything like that. But yeah, I think it's good. What's been on your turntable?
Well, this might surprise you. I've been listening to – my wife and I have been listening to a fair bit of T-Rex, Mark Bolan. Mm. And, okay. you know, one of the – maybe call him the grandfather of glam rock.
Yep.
And not so much albums because, you know, he was the – had a lot of singles out, a lot of hit singles. And even as a kid, and I mean very, very young because we're talking about – we're starting here in 1970 – but so I was just a baby, but I do remember you're supposed to laugh there, Brian, but I
didn't want to insult you because I knew you weren't being quite honest there,
but I do remember
you were at least a preteen at best.
I do remember time and place of hearing a number of, T-Rex's songs coming out on the radio. And, you know, we talked earlier about AM radio back in the day and, you know, the 3 minute hits, you know. Now, a lot of people might think, oh, T-Rex, Mark Bolan, one-hit wonder, but he had so many big hits. And so I've been listening to, you know, Get It On, Bang a Gong, Telegram Sam, Metal Guru, my favorite of his, Children of the Revolution. But there's so many to quote that we've been listening to, but mainly his hits. There's only one or two that I don't really like. So that's what we've been listening to here at home a fair bit. And I'll tell you this, I'd actually considered maybe one day, perhaps when we run out of ideas, we could even look at Mark Bolan, because I don't know if you know, but he's got a very interesting background, a very interesting philosophy. We could do a show on him. If you would like us to do a show on T-Rex / Mark Bolan, write to us and let us know, because there is a lot more to him than just those glam rock one-hit wonder that many people think he is, but he's not. He had so many hits, it's just not funny. But yeah, so that's what we've been listening to. Anyway, all right, we might leave it there. Just one more thing before we go. I wanted to make note of this. A couple of people have asked me why we don't include too many clips of the artists that we're talking about. Now, the reason I don't do that, and it's I'm doing that on purpose. I want to avoid any copyright issues like with YouTube. They take videos down and all this sort of thing. We're only talking about their music in a way to give them a review. We're not trying to sell music or do anything like that. We're just discussing the artists and reviewing their work. But, you know, strange things happen on YouTube, and sometimes the video becomes unplayable in certain parts of the world because there's a copyright claim or whatever. So the other reason I don't is that the music that we talk about is so widely available. Any song that we've just discussed today of any of these artists, I'm not sure about Fandango, but all of these others, go to YouTube and type it in. It'll be there. Like, you can just go and listen to it. So I don't really need to play them. I'd like to play them. I'd like to play more music, but I just want to avoid those copyright issues because they do pop up from time to time, but we're not out to take anybody's fame or anything like that. If you do notice, we offer a fair critique on the people that we talk about. And that's not being critical, it's a critique, and you can look that up for yourself what a real critique is. So for more, find us at www.likeflitradio.com. That's the new home of Philosopher Rock. Also find us on our YouTube channel, and please remember to like and subscribe. You want to write to us directly, you can email us at philosopherrock@gmail.com. So from me, I'll just like to say thank you for your time. Thank you for listening to us. And thank you, Brian, for your time. And I'll say God bless and hooroo.
Yes, and I echo those sentiments as well. I want to say thank you, Garth, for doing this particular episode. It kind of reminded me of what I liked about the Doors. They're not one that I typically go to listen to. So it's kind of like with Jethro Tull, it's kind of like a refreshing reminiscence of what I liked about the Doors and getting back into it. And I appreciate your willingness to do the show with me. I appreciate the listeners tuning in. Again, just echoing Garth's sentiments, go to our YouTube page and click the subscribe button. We need people to click that for some reason. I don't know what it does. Garth knows what it does, but it does something. And it does something good. So please do that. Because we don't live in a nihilistic worldview. We think there's a purpose. And even though your purpose is not just to click subscribe buttons, that would be one thing that would help us out. And in closing, I'll just say, I'll quote Jim Morrison and say, if all else fails, we can whip the horse's eyes and make them sleep and cry.